By the mercy of my spiritual master, even a blind man can see stars in the sky, a lame man can cross mountains, and a dumb man can recite poetry. You know what dumb means? Dumb means he can't speak. Not that he's stupid. Did you know that? In English? Dumb means can't speak. I mean, dumb also means stupid. But dumb also means you can't speak. So, we don't know what we're going to speak about, so you can ask questions. You have a question?
Vana Shandama, specifically about the Brahmana Kshatriya Rasha Shuddha. And I can't understand, you emphasize the word, you don't understand how it's.
You emphasize Vana Sham a lot and you can't understand?
The Brahmana Kshatriya, the Rasha Shuddha.
The Varna, Brahman, Varna, Kshatriya Varna.
Is it Prabhupada mentioning in his book for the future, or it's because for today's book?
Not relevant. He's asking if the Varnashram is relevant. If his Prabhupada talks about it, was he talking about it for the future? Or was he talking about it for now? Depends who you ask the question. There are a lot of devotees into establishing Varnashram now. There's a. Right. So Prabhupada wanted us. There was a conversation, and many devotees were. It was at a point in ISKCON where a lot of devotees were having trouble being devotees. So Prabhupada said, we need Varnashram. So my understanding is that there are many people who want to practice Krishna consciousness who can't fully, or are fully qualified or unable in some way to fully practice Krishna consciousness. That's where they can find a place. And I think Prabhupada's vision was also for society in general. It's a little difficult to understand, but there are devotees now who are very much wanting to establish Varnashram in communities. Understanding exactly how that would be is maybe a bit controversial. Advaita Swami said, you see it in India in the villages. I don't know if you've been to Vrindavan, you'll see schools and just training Brahmin boys. They come from Brahmin families, they get Brahmin education, they'll be priests. That's their job. Yes?
If you can see, just along this idea, you can see that just like story of King Priyavrata, that he was reluctant to enter into the duty of the king. He was kind of inspired to.
Grihastha, yeah, the whole thing.
Yes, and somehow or other he was convinced by Brahma to enter into that, because his reluctance was that if I get involved, I will become attached, and this attachment can cover my consciousness. So the duty of a manager entails being too much involved, and because he's too much involved, he may not see the whole picture, he may not be connected. And there should be someone who is really detached that can inspire him and connect him to the spiritual and cooperation between them and really benefit the whole society. So it's not just what the Prabhupada said, but actually it's really relevant.
It's a difficult subject, and I'm a little reluctant to speak on it. But the short answer is Prabhupada's point is wanting to establish it.
as soon as we could establish it. How it would look and how it would be established initially, and different devotees have different ideas. But if you're a Vaishnava, then Prabhupada said you're not part of it. You just teach other people how to do their duty. I think it also is relevant to raising children and understanding their natural inclination and supporting them. But like you said, the thing about Priyavrata is very interesting, and it's very difficult to understand how he did this. He wanted to remain a renunciate, right? And apparently he was the most qualified person to rule. And because they couldn't find anybody as qualified, there was a concern that there would be problems. Such a concern that Lord Brahma had to come because he was refusing to take the post. And they couldn't find anybody. Apparently there wasn't anybody to take the post. So he was asked to do it, and then he had to get married. And so Prabhupada describes that, about how he did it. And it's very difficult for a Western mind to understand what Prabhupada said. It's almost insulting, especially to the women. But I'll say it and explain it. I'll risk insulting you. Are you ready to be insulted? I don't think insulting is a good word. It's not insulting, but you may feel insulted. Thank you. Good. Lemonade for time. So, the first principle is, ladies, don't marry a man who doesn't really want to get married. Well, most of you are already married, so you don't have to worry. You can just lament if you already did it. But one of the things you find, one of the phenomena you find in an organization that has monks or renunciates, celibates, is that they get married and they don't change their ashram. They just change their name, their position. Now they're married, but they still think like an unmarried person. Because they're renounced. They're a little too renounced. But, you know, question, why would you get married if you're so renounced? But sometimes they enter married life, but they don't adjust. They still kind of remain like a monk or a renunciate. Which was a little bit how Maharaj Priyavrata was. He was very, very spiritually elevated. So he wasn't really attached to his wife or his children. There's a story, I think it was Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, very, very renounced. And he would, like, neglect his wife. He wouldn't sleep in the same room or anything. So his guru said, you have to sleep with your wife and to take care of her. So he got in the bed next to her, and all night he stayed up chanting japa. Because that's who he was. He was just detached. So Maharaj Priyavrata was very detached. And women like men who are detached, but they don't like men who are too detached. Because if they're too detached, then they don't care so much. So they don't show, like, the natural affection. Is that true? Or am I wrong? I don't know. What do you think? I mean, if your husband's too detached, then...
Unless it is their duty to be attached. They are detached, but not their duty to be attached.
Mm-hmm. You're jumping the gun. That's the point I was getting to. But sometimes I've seen... Well, it depends on the woman. Sometimes the husband's too detached. And maybe the woman feels he's cold or not interested in family life. But Priyavrata was like that. He was very detached. But Prabhupada says, and this is the part that could be insulting or very difficult to understand, he acted like he was attached. He wasn't attached, but he acted towards his wife and his family as if he were. So that's like... You marry some guy, he's completely detached, and he fakes it. And he says, I love you. And you say, no, you don't. I know you don't. Yes. Not fake it exactly.
It may not be accurate.
That he was faking it?
There is no real need for fake. Because faking means he's not fulfilling his duty. He's not real, he's not doing his job because he's faking it.
But no, he was doing his job, he was just...
No, because the real, what I mean is that the real attachment should be Krishna. And on behalf of Krishna, he should be attached. So that means he's ultimately attached to Krishna and not to his wife. But on behalf of Krishna, he's very attached. He may be very attached, really attached, not fake, to his wife. It's an art.
But he wasn't. But then what you say is true. And I see it differently. I mean, in his situation. This is how I understand it. I'm getting it. He showed affection to his wife. There's no question. And to his family. Perfect. More affection than probably any husband. But Prabhupada says he wasn't attached. And Prabhupada says, we have to find the purport if we can find it. I'm trying to think what Prabhupada says. I don't know if he uses the word pretending or the indication he was doing it, but it wasn't there. What? No. He wasn't attached. The point. Priyavrata?
Yeah.
I don't think so. What? Find it. I don't think so. Because the moral of the story, which I'm trying to get to, is that this is very hard to understand for Western mind because it doesn't fit in our culture. That he was a better husband than any husband. And he showed more affection than any husband.
Yes.
But you know why. Why? He didn't want to do it, but he did it perfectly. Why? Because he did it as his dharma. You don't love me, it's only because it's your dharma. That's the Western mind, right? You just love me because it's your dharma.
Spiritual relationship. It seems that life should be very happy
when
you have a very dark or very fast. But my point is that we want to be elevated
to this
position.
Yes.
This is the goal.
Yes. It's interesting. I had a conversation with Bhakti Purnaswami on this topic. And he was saying that most relationships in Western mind are based on how much you like the other person and how well you can get along. How much you love one another, how much affection is there, the similarities and so forth. And the problem is when something happens, you realize maybe you don't like them as much as you thought. It creates a problem. But when you go to a higher level where it's dharmic, then you are a better husband and a better wife and a better son because it's your duty to show affection. So it doesn't matter if you like her or you don't like her. It's your duty. You take care. So he was detached and he's showing affection. And then, he said an interesting thing. He said that in his counseling, his marriage counseling to Westerners, he explains the idea of dharma in marriage. Because you can have this affection, and in one sense, the relationship on the material level would not be perfect. There may be things you don't like about it. But because you're on the dharmic level, you do it perfectly. Go ahead.
When I noticed about perfection is when you have a duty and you serve, there's an awakening.
For the service itself?
Because make you feel a small text. And you start to feel it. But you become affectionate. So if it's your duty to serve your family or anyone else, by serving them directly, you become affectionate also. It's kind of the heart is going also.
Yeah. I think it's true for Indians more than Westerners. We asked, and one devotee asked an Indian couple, their marriage was arranged. And they asked that question, well, how does it work if he didn't have affection? How does it work? And he said, well, by serving, the affection comes.
Yes.
So Bhaktivedanta Swami was saying this dharmic concept, he said he's explained it to many grihasthas, and he said that when the grihastha is very focused on the relationship, the relationship has to be perfect, and the dharmic concept, it doesn't register, because it's not inbred in the Western psyche, dharma, so much. I mean, it is a little bit, but you get married, and they say, at least in America, they say, do you promise to stay with this person through happiness and distress? You know, whatever they say. I don't
get it.
Right? Life or death, you know. So that's a dharmic thing. And they'll say yes. You know, as long as she stays beautiful, doesn't get too fat, you know, doesn't have a relationship with another guy, doesn't talk back to me, and the relationship is good, yes. Right? So the dharmic concept is, you know, it's my duty, so I do it perfectly. I show perfect affection, I take care of everyone. And I don't reject it. It doesn't bother me. I don't say I don't like it. But that was his experience. It was difficult for a Western mind. He said he doesn't even. He's kind of given up speaking like that because maybe he's speaking to young people in the West. They have a very hard time understanding that idea. But I need to love her. There's a story early in the movement when Prabhupada started talking about arranged marriage. Of course, in America, we've never heard of arranged marriages, and that's what Prabhupada was doing. You marry him, you marry him, you marry him. So, the devotee said, but how will the love develop? Prabhupada said, love? He said, love is for Krishna. He says, because Prabhupada was coming from this dharmic point of view. You know, it's like you get a job, and do you love your boss? What do you mean, love my boss? I work for him. You know? So that's the way, love is for Krishna. And so Prabhupada, you know, it's like family, you know, it's different than love. It's dharma. It's a different thing. But it's, I think a lot of devotees like to say affection rather than love. And in my wife's video, I don't know if you remember, this one devotee, Pranada, she said, I gave my love to men. She said, but I realized there's a special kind of love that's only for God, and only God can reciprocate that love.
Yes.
So that's what Prabhupada meant. You know, love, that's for Krishna. You know. So then on a morning walk, Prabhupada was asked, you know, the devotees were confused in the early days. They said, what about affection for children? Prabhupada said, that's natural. You don't become so affectionate, you lose your mind. And the Prabhupada said, if you're affectionate, then you'll raise them to be Krishna conscious. That's how you show your affection. Natural affection. And you'll help your wife be Krishna conscious. The wife will help the husband. That's natural affection. Right? That's real affection. Anyway, dharma is an interesting concept because it's there's a part of our brain that sometimes doesn't register when we talk about applied dharma in certain situations. Yes?
Actually, it's very interesting because if we're supposed to apply the Bhagavad Gita, the Bhagavad Gita is teaching the concept of dharma.
Yes.
So what's the point of studying the Bhagavad Gita without the self-analyzing and application?
It's a very good point. the reality that you read something and you think you understand it, and you go out in life and you don't realize you didn't understand it, but everybody else does. This is a huge, how should we say, it's a concern, obstacle. I mean, actually becoming the teachings that we teach other people to become. Yeah, okay, so here's Arjuna. He's on the battlefield. And Krishna says, okay, here's the program. You fight, and don't worry about winning. And don't worry about losing. And don't worry if you're honored or defamed. You just fight. That's it. This is your duty, you fight. Wow. What's that all about? Everybody wants to be successful, right? They want to have a successful marriage, a successful business. We want to have a successful company, so what do? We fudge, we lie about on our accounts to satisfy the people who own our stocks. And 3 years later, the company, because we were dissolves, goes bankrupt, because we were trying to be successful. We weren't trying to be dharmic. When you're dharmic, you do the right thing, then you get success. That's the idea. I was in India, staying at some friend's home, and I said, how many divorce, what's the divorce rate in India? He said, practically zero. I said, why? He said, because we grow up learning marriage is one time. That's in our blood, it's in our culture, it's in our brain. That's our, you know, that's there. You only get married once. So, you have to make it work, because you only have one chance. Can't do anything. It's a different idea. But it's a nice, it's an important point. When Krishna is telling, don't try to be successful, just be dharmic. Right?
But it implies something very interesting. That if you follow this scheme, you will be successful
yes.
On the spiritual path.
Yes. And materially. The last verse of the Gita, what does it say? Who knows? Yatta Yogeshwara Krishna Yatta Partha Dhanam Dula Tattu Sri Vijayo Bhutira. There'll be victory. Tatra, there'll be victory. What else? Morality. What else? Anyway, you'll be successful. Opulence. One, another one. There'll be opulence. Wherever there's Krishna and Arjuna, there'll be success, there'll be opulence, there'll be morality. But Krishna's saying, fight and don't try to be successful. But you get all the, wherever there's Krishna and Arjuna, you get all those things. Because it's wherever there's Dharma, that's what happens. Even non-devotee people say, don't try to be successful, just try to do the right thing and you'll be successful as a byproduct. You know, a lot of times devotees would develop different preaching programs. And some of them Prabhupada felt were a little too compromised. And he would say, our goal is to please Krishna and Krishna will do everything. So, like, do the right thing, and Krishna will do it. But like, so many things where Prabhupada asks us to do, we think, well, why? It doesn't make sense. So, no, you do this, and you'll be successful. Not that he didn't let us use our intelligence, but some things we didn't understand. Do you want to hear a funny one about marriage? Prabhupada was playing a joke on a devotee. She was in taking Prabhupada's darshan with her husband. Prabhupada said, "Who do you love more, Krishna or your husband?" And she started crying. She explained why. She said, "I knew I didn't love Krishna, and I didn't love my husband either." Yes.
Buddha saying that in my Radhika Maharaj, in one of the lecture that for a woman it's a dharma and for a man it's a dark well.
It's what?
Dark well. And when the children going up, the woman should be happy that her husband will take some gas and she will develop more attachment to Krishna.
Oh. You want to hear something? Want to hear something funny that he said also? I was in Dallas, and it must have been 10 years ago or something. But most of the devotees were in their 50s in the temple, 50 or older. He gave a whole lecture on vanaprastha, how you should all retire or start retiring, slowing down. Slow down the business, you know, smaller house, you know, just reduce, simplify. Whole lecture for like an hour, convincing everybody to do it. At the end, he stopped the lecture. He said, "I don't know why I gave this lecture, because none of you are going to do this." I was already thinking that after 5 minutes. Why is he giving this lecture? Nobody's going to do it. But sometimes you just have to say it anyway. Now the thing is also, Prabhupada said a lot of things, but some of the things he said were kind of experimental. Like, this is a tradition. But he wasn't always certain it was going to work in America. So when he was speaking about Gurukul, in one letter he said, the Gurukul experiment. So it wasn't an absolute thing, it was trying. It's important to understand that. The Prabhupada tried things. If it didn't work, he would adjust. So sometimes he would start with a very Vedic traditional idea. And you would have to see if you could implant that in a Western culture. Sometimes you could and sometimes you couldn't. One devotee told us, would ask Prabhupada, why 16 rounds? Where did that number come from? Did it come from Shastra? And Prabhupada said, "No, I made it up." And he said, "Why?" He said, "Because I was..." And they said, "Well, why did you ask them to devotees to chant 64 rounds? He said, "I was testing to see if they could." And they said, "No." 32, they said, "No." Then he said, 16, "You can't do any less." They said, "Okay." So, sometimes it happened like that. The Prabhupada was just trying things and adjusting what worked, what didn't work. Now the other interesting thing is that you see a lot of things going on in ISKCON and you think Prabhupada established them, but a lot of it was the devotees themselves, their own inspiration. It wasn't like Prabhupada said, "Do this." It was just an inspiration they got from hearing Prabhupada, reading his books, that they could understand this would be something he would want. I want to tell you a really good story. You want to hear a good story? You could only hear this from me because no one else knows it. Who wants to hear a good story? This is so interesting, this story. I'm going to tell you two stories, and you'll have never heard either one, because unless you lived in San Diego between 1972 and 1974, you would never hear these stories. So, in America, there was a time when we went out in public only in our dhoti and kurta. And then there was a time we went out in Western dress. And many of you know that, in distributing Prabhupada's books. but you don't know why. Your common sense tells you we went out in Western dress because it's easier to distribute books. That's not why we, how we discovered it. You want to know how we discovered it? It was an accident. In America, in the early 70s, there were shopping malls, indoor and outdoor malls, but the way the law was at that time, that even though it was private property, because it was open to the public, we had access as a religious group, a First Amendment, to practice our religion so we could go to the malls. So we used to do Harinam up and, you know, up and down malls. And they were the best places to distribute our books. Then the law changed around 1972. Then we still wanted to go to the malls because the malls were like the downtown. In America, the downtowns became kind of obsolete, and they were the malls in the suburbs where is where everybody shopped. And more, a lot of downtowns were where the poor people lived. So the devotees in San Diego were traveling all around America, and they would go to the malls, and the security would ask them to leave. So they thought, we have to take these dhotis and saris off because we stand out. We should just dress like everybody else and they won't notice us. It wasn't an idea that it'll be easier to distribute books out. That's how it came. Did you know that? No. There was a huge controversy in America when we started dressing this way. It went right to Prabhupada. There was a whole debate going on. Anyway, I was in San Diego, and we didn't like it. We thought, you don't have to wear, this is 74, you don't have to wear this Western dress. If the devotees are just, they don't have faith. You should go out in dhotis. So we went out in dhoti and sari. Well, we didn't wear sari. Oh, here's a side point. Here's another story. I'll just, Prabhupada would sometimes preach, and he'd go off on a tangent. So this is a story about a man wearing a sari. You want to hear about the man who wore the sari?
Yes.
This is a great story. You probably never heard this because you have to be in Berkeley in 1969 to know this story. Or have been there and remember it from your last life. So, I'm coming to the temple, everything's fine. So many people are coming. You know, when you're coming to the temple and so many guests are coming, and we know them because they're always there, so we make friends with them. So this man's coming to the temple, you know, chanting his japa, learning Krishna consciousness. One day he shows up in a sari. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna. Whoa. What do you do with him or her? This is the beginning of the movement. You know. He comes back next week in a dhoti. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna. Comes back next week in a sari. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. There's a woman in the Brahmacharya Ashram. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. The temple president writes Prabhupada. He tells him, because we're just young devotees, we don't know anything. Like, we ask Prabhupada everything. I mean, you'd be surprised what we'd ask Prabhupada. I'm going to move up to the, up here. So, describe the whole thing to Prabhupada. Should I tell you what Prabhupada said? Prabhupada said, tell him to decide what he is and continue his Krishna consciousness. That was it. Wow. I mean, nowadays you'd have like 25 meetings to figure out what to do. Anyway, so it was 1974. We were thinking the fact that the devotees are not wearing dhoti and sari is a lack of faith. That you can go out and people will see you're a religious person. So we got all fired up. We went out Christmas in our dhotis and saris. We did just as good. We were puffed up. We were proud. So we wrote Prabhupada a letter and we told him what we did. We're thinking, we broke through. You know, this is it. You know, Prabhupada's going to write the whole movement and tell them, you don't need to wear Western dress. That's what we thought. We're really proud writing this letter. Dodi's sorry, you can do it. Yeah. We didn't tell Prabhupada to tell the whole movement, but we thought he would. Our devotees in San Diego are distributing books and saris and dhotis. It's clear that this is Western dress. It's a compromise and not necessary. That's what we thought he would say. So he writes us back. He says, if you feel more comfortable wearing a dhoti or a sari, that's fine. That one sentence totally blew our ego. And I think Prabhupada knew our mind. He knew. And that's why he just blew us off. You want to hear another story? How Prabhupada understood my mind?
Yes, but what did other people choose, to be man or woman?
What did he choose?
Probably choose not to be.
I don't know. I don't remember. I think he just disappeared. I don't remember after that. Because he had to choose, and I guess he couldn't choose. But he could just, on the day he chose to be one of them, he could have just come to the temple. The day he chose to be another, he could stay home. We had another incident like that. Another boy came to the temple, but he was a girl. He was, you know, hanging out in the Brahmacharya ashram, sewing and making garlands and freaking all the women out. Can you get this guy out of here? So they say religious movements do attract that type of person. I mean, statistics, not our movement, all movements. Anyway, so I was temple president in 1970, and there were no GBCs. So the temple presidents would write a report every month and send it to Prabhupada, what's going on in their temple. So it was a great opportunity for me to ask Prabhupada questions. Because I had to send the letter, I had to write the letter anyway. But this is, we distributed this many books, these many people joined, we did these festivals, and I'd ask a question sometimes. So I had an idea. I was thinking, for book distribution, I was thinking if we had a famous band, they would play, 10,000 people would come, and then we'd just give everyone a book. Because they pay so much money to come. And then I was thinking that whatever we say in our songs would influence them, because that's how that generation was influenced. It was all through the music. The hippie generation was all influenced through music. One scholar said the greatest contribution of the hippies was their songs. You know, Bob Dylan and this, you know, it's just like, they study Bob Dylan in colleges in America. So I wrote Prabhupada a letter and I said, we should start a band and become famous. And then when we become famous, we'll have these concerts, we'll influence people by the lyrics of our song, and we'll distribute all the books. Good idea? Mm-hmm. Prabhupada wrote back and said, you'll never become famous. And then he said something really interesting which totally caught me off guard. He said, don't try to become famous. Try to make Krishna famous. And my response was, I'm not trying to become famous. I was just want the band to become famous because then they'll preach. And then I thought, the fact that Prabhupada said that, he must know what's going on in my mind. And before I was a devotee, I wanted to be a rock star. So Prabhupada saw it all coming out. And he caught me on it. So, of course, that's the duty of the guru, to see, you know, what the disciple can't see. You want to hear some more crazy stories about early days in ISKCON? You can ask questions. I don't have to tell you. You want to hear crazy stories? I don't know. You sure?
Yes.
There was a, this is not a story, this is just an observation. Just, you can put this in your memory bank, just as an observation. I went to a temple. I didn't know what was going on at the temple. I went to Mangalarti. There were 20 women at Mangalarti. And as soon as the arti began, they started dancing and jumping. For the whole arti, 30 minutes, non-stop jumping. First thought in my mind was, something's wrong. That was my first thought. This is not, there's too much enthusiasm. Something's wrong. And something was very wrong. I don't want to tell you what was wrong. It would disgust you. But something was very wrong. And I knew it because there was like too much Krishna consciousness externally.
Who was the man there?
What?
Who was the man there?
Jiva. His name was Jiva. Who was in charge of the women? The man?
They were dancing for this.
No, dancing for the deities, Mangalarti. It was just abnormal level of Krishna consciousness. And immediately after a few seconds, I thought something's wrong. This is not normal. You can just consider that. You see, too much. There's a Bengali saying: too much devotion is a sign of a thief. It was like too much bhakti. It was abnormal bhakti. Bhaktisiddhanta used to have disciples, and they weren't good disciples, but they'd always be paying obeisances. You know that kind of person, the kind of not really good for anything, but they pay obeisances. Called them Dandavad devotees or something. So there was a devotee named Vishal. He lived in Vrindavan when Prabhupada was there. When Prabhupada would go on the morning walk, Vishal would probably, you were the master of the ship over the ocean of Kali. He would chant all these verses and Prabhupada would say, do something useful. So there's a kind of devotee that just, you know, like, likes to glorify and pay obeisances, be humble, but doesn't really do anything. There's another nice story. And there are many stories like this. This is a very instructive story about humility. There's a devotee named Amoga, who's now in Vrindavan. He's an American devotee. He was living in Australia. I don't know if I told you the story. Prabhupada was giving a lecture and someone had a Bhagavatam on the floor and Prabhupada said, don't put it on the floor. Did I tell this story before?
No.
No? And he said, don't put it on the floor. So then Amoga thought, I'll make a book cover for Prabhupada's book. Because Prabhupada said, don't put it on the floor. But he was getting puffed up already making it. And he got a nice dini cloth and he was thinking, this is going to be the best gift and Prabhupada's going to praise me. And I'll get praised in front of everybody. So Prabhupada was having darshan and he came in with the bag. Prabhupada said, what's in the bag? He said, oh Prabhupada, I made a book cover for your Bhagavatam. He said, what is this? He said, because in class in the morning you said, don't put the Bhagavatam on the floor. So if I make the cover, it's not on the floor. Prabhupada said, I don't put my Bhagavatam on the floor. And he just like deflated him. Because the devotee knew that Prabhupada was just cutting down because he was proud. I don't put my Bhagavatam on the floor. You put yours on the floor. I don't put mine on the floor. I don't need your stupid gift. Like that. Just deflated him. Hit the ground. He had some mangoes in there in his bed. Prabhupada said, what else? So now he was down here. And he brought Prabhupada the mangoes. Prabhupada said, oh, mangoes. King of fruits. And he was very, very happy. And there are many stories like this. When a devotee would come and they weren't pure in their intention and they were exhibiting pride, Prabhupada would do something to just pop that pride. And just like, you totally ignore somebody. Somebody would come, totally ignore them because they have the wrong mood. He knew the mood. He would do something to them. He didn't like that mood at all.
When I came humbly, then he accepted their service. And many stories. I mean, this is very common. I just heard an interesting story. Maybe I heard it here. Maybe somebody here told me. Somebody tell me this story about Bhakti Siddhanta and someone's not chanting their rounds? Yeah. And Bhakti Siddhanta is saying, no, I know he's always chanting 64 rounds, meaning what he's always chanting in his mind. And so the spiritual master, he sees the mood and mentality of the disciple. And if there's something wrong, I mean, there's stories like that where Prabhupada just like totally neglected somebody because they were proud. Yes?
Maybe you can speak about your meeting with Srila Prabhupada.
My meeting? I can tell you one nice story. Maybe two. First, what I would like to say. Let's say something about Prabhupada and how he operated. And this story will help you understand how he operated. This is amazing. I was, as I said, I was temple president. And so we went to San Francisco. I was in Canada. We went to San Francisco to the Rath Yatra Festival. And I got a message that there would be a meeting for all the temple presidents with Prabhupada. But the message during Rath Yatra. So you imagine you got a message like that? I'd never been in the same room with Prabhupada. I'd seen him. I got initiated from him. Personally initiated in the temple, but I'd never been in a room, in a meeting. So the whole Rath Yatra, I'm thinking, what's this meeting going to be like? President's meeting. And what does a president's meeting sound like? Important, you know, matters will be discussed, policies will be made, right? Resolutions passed, something like that. So I'm going through my mind and thinking, because I didn't know how Prabhupada operated. So we got to the meeting, Prabhupada had some dried fruit on his plate, he had just eaten and he was giving it to everybody coming in, so we all got some maha. We sat down. There wasn't that many of us, maybe eight. He started talking to us about preaching Krishna consciousness. Just enthusing us to spread Krishna consciousness. And then asking us, what are you doing? What are you doing regarding preaching? How many temples have you opened? What temple are you going to open? And in those days, opening temples was the program. Just enthusing and encouraging us. And then the meeting was over. No resolutions, no policy, nothing practical, nothing really practical per se. You know, I mean, you could say it was the most practical because now everybody was enthused to go out and preach, but nothing. You do this, you do this, you do this. So I had been with Prabhupada other times, morning walks in his room for darshan in his class. And particularly going in his room for darshan is very interesting. Because I would sit there and I'd think, he's running the whole movement. And I would try to analyze, how is he running it? But every time I'm with him, he was just preaching. So it was a little bewildering to me, you know, because he's running the whole movement, you know. So running the whole movement, you'd think, a couple phones. Those days of the telex, few offices of secretaries, you know, two phones, you're busy managing two phones, and just tell the secretary, you do that, you do that, hold on a second, you do this, you do that, we right back with you. So what do you say? Yeah, get that done. Yeah. Hold on a second, you know, that's what I thought. You know, get that fax, you know, send that email. And you're going to Prabhupada's room, and he's just
preaching. You're thinking, how is the movement going on? And then one of his servants, Sri Tikirti, he said, well, what did Prabhupada do in his spare time? He said he read his books. And he had nothing else to do, he read his books. So he wasn't busy, busy, at least in America, it wasn't busy, 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 busy. India more so. But in America, you know, everything's going on and he's just sitting behind his desk preaching to people. And you're trying to figure out, how is this whole movement going on? Yes?
This was the example of Maharaj to embrace Vaidmana Krishna. He was just doing his puja and seva, and his ministers did everything perfectly.
Yeah. Prabhupada was very detached in America. He really let his disciples do everything. In India, he had to do more. Because India was a different field, and we make mistakes. But in America, basically us doing everything. That requires detachment. Oh, I didn't tell you. I have to tell you the story that I told the devotees yesterday. This is an amazing story. This story actually increased my faith about 10,000%. And I was telling this story in relation to the holy name being Krishna and relating that to the deity being Krishna. Where they both require faith. And it's because you treat the deity as Krishna, you honor the deity as Krishna, you worship the deity as Krishna, then Krishna reveals himself through the deity in the same way you worship the holy name as Krishna, you honor the holy name as Krishna, you treat the holy name as Krishna. And then the holy name reveals itself as Krishna. So, would you like to hear an amazing story? It's not about me, but I was there at the time. When Prabhupada was in Los Angeles, there was one devotee that was not allowed to meet him at the airport because he had to stay in the temple fixing something. So he had just finished fixing it and he was right up in front of the temple by the deities, by Rukmini Dorkini. She had three altars. So here's Gauri Thai, Rukmini Dorkini, and Jagannath. He was right here. And then when Prabhupada came, 500 devotees just closed in on the temple. And so he was finishing his work and he couldn't move. There was nowhere to move. He was surrounded by devotees. So Prabhupada came, paid obeisances to Gauri Thai, and the devotee was standing here. Then Prabhupada comes. And he couldn't move. And he was right next to Prabhupada, and he's Prabhupada's height. Same height. Prabhupada was short. Like 5'4 or something. Can you do feet here?
No.
5 feet is what? Anyway.
Maybe like this. Prabhupada was like. Yeah. Something, maybe. Yeah, maybe somewhere around here. So the devotee was the same height, and he was
right next to Prabhupada. And Prabhupada was talking to the deities, to Rukmini Dorkinish. And this loud kirtan was going on, and he was right next to Prabhupada, and he was the only one that could hear it. And Prabhupada said, so? They're taking care of you nicely? And he waited. And after a few seconds, Prabhupada said, oh, good. And they're dressing you nicely? And he waited. He said, oh, very good. And they're feeding you nicely? He waited. He said, oh, nice. That's good, I'm happy. And the devotee said, when he was interviewed for the Leelamrita, he told the story, and the devotee interviewing him walked out, said, you're a liar. He walked out. And this devotee said, I mean, there's no reason for him to lie, but what Prabhupada said on the Vyasa-san confirms
the story. He said, then Prabhupada, after greeting the deities, went on Vyasa-san and told the devotees, I can see that the deities are very happy that you're taking care of them nicely. You like that story? That's an amazing story, isn't it? Such a faith builder to hear that kind of thing. He asked, why is Prabhupada speaking English to the deity? Should he speak Bengali? Hindi? Hey Prabhu, kya hai? Bhagavacha. Hey Prabhu, Bhagavacha. He was in America, speak American, speak English.
They must understand. So many people are approaching them with English speaking, so they must
understand. Of course. Krishna is the origin of English, right?
Yeah.
Sarva Karana Karana. Then, one time in Los Angeles, Prabhupada came. And he asked the Hempajari, how are the deities? Are they happy? No one ever asked the Hempajari that question. I don't know properly. You should know. If you're Krishna conscious, you'll know if your deities are happy. But the deities were happy, and Prabhupada told her. And he said, I can see you're taking nice care of the deities. By this service, you'll go back home, back to Gaza. Because the deities were happy. Wow. Now I want to tell you another story. This is really cool. You want to hear a cool story? I was in Mayapur one day walking with my daughter in the evening, and a lot of shops sell DVDs, so they play the DVDs on the little television, and I'm walking by and I see this DVD and it's Los Angeles when I lived there. I said to my daughter, let's buy the DVD, maybe you'll see me there. I had hair then, you see me with hair and Sika, wow. So we buy the DVD, and on the DVD, they have the installation of Rukmini Durgadish, and I was there. So I know when it was, and I know all the devotees. So we're watching the installation, and they're going through the whole process, installing the deities, doing the bathing, putting them on the altar, and then it shows the kirtan, and then it shows after that a class. Now the interesting thing about ISKCON DVDs is you can't always tell the year because the dress style never changes. So you might tell it by the quality of the photography, but and if you go early enough in ISKCON, then the men wore yellow and the women wore solid yellow. The married men and women wore solid yellow, and then the Brahmacharinis wore saffron saris. So you know, but at a certain like after 1972, at a certain point, you couldn't really tell. So we're watching this video, and I knew everything about it. I knew the year, I knew the devotees, I knew how old they were, I knew how long they'd been devotees. So we're watching this. You know, it just looks like a typical temple in ISKCON, you know, or even more than typical. These people, very enthusiastic. Kirtan, very enthusiastic, and probably giving a lecture. Everybody rapt attention. And then the bathing ceremony performed really well. You can see, you know, very sincere devotees. I turned to my daughter and I said, Braja, the average devotee in this temple has not been a devotee yet for even a year. And the average age is about 20. I said, can you tell from this video they've only been devotees a year? She said, no. They look like they've been devotees 30 years. Then you see Prabhupada's giving the class and everybody's like this. Just rapt attention. Then you see the kirtan and everybody's completely enthusiastic. I said to my daughter, I said, Braja, do you understand Prabhupada's potency? These people 8 months ago were not devotees. And you can't tell. From this video, you cannot tell. They just look like they've been devotees all their lives, by their enthusiasm, by their dedication. It was just a very interesting realization I had of Prabhupada's power. These people were walking on the street 8 months, a year ago, 6 months ago, doing, you know, what they were doing. And now they're installing deities. Amazing, Prabhupada's power. Now I'll tell you why. Would you like to know why? Should I tell you? I got that one from Ramana's Swami. And Nadia Rina's Swami. Should I tell you? You want to hear? Krishna wanted to spread Krishna consciousness. And he had to send somebody who, by whose presence, just by seeing them, you'd want to be a devotee. If you had any inclination at all, by seeing this person, you'd want to be a devotee. Not just a devotee, but you'd want to be a pure devotee. So, Prabhupada's presence in the Western world was so powerful that in his presence, if anyone had any inclination for bhakti, it would just come out of their heart. And Prabhupada's power was such that it would come very strongly out of the heart. It would start gushing out of the heart. And there are many, many devotees who knew very little about Krishna consciousness, who you could say were not very advanced, but in Prabhupada's presence, they just wanted to serve him and give their life to him. They didn't know much about Krishna, and they really didn't have a strong desire to serve Krishna, but they had a desire to serve Prabhupada. And they gave their whole life to Prabhupada. So Prabhupada brought that out of the heart, and they gave themselves to spreading Krishna consciousness. I told that story. Did I tell the story the other night about Prabhupada waking up the devotee? So, you know, Prabhupada's mood was, everyone, dedicate yourself. And so his presence really brought that out. And you can see in retrospect, Krishna had to send somebody who could bring that out of people's hearts. There were so many people that came, helped Prabhupada spread Krishna consciousness. Prabhupada left, they were gone. He did amazing service, amazingly dedicated. Prabhupada left, they were gone. Krishna was the only way they could be Krishna conscious. And they established so many programs and did so much. You see Prabhupada, you just see him. That's it. Did you ever see Prabhupada going out with him? You just see him. It's like Maya shot dead. Tell you a nice story. You want to hear a nice story? This is an example of what I'm saying, to help you understand that. But what I would say, what we can get from this, I'll tell the story, then you remind me if I don't tell you what we can get from this. I had a godbrother, amazing godbrother, he's still a godbrother. Prabhupada came to Los Angeles, we're all in Los Angeles, and this godbrother goes to the airport to greet Prabhupada, as we all do. And he tells me, I'm not going back to the temple to see Prabhupada. I'm going to stay at the airport and distribute 108 big books. And I said, how are you going to do it? He said, if I just see Prabhupada for 1 second, I can do it. So we all came through with Prabhupada. And he was there, so I talked to him. I said, so what are you going to do? And he said, I saw Prabhupada for a second. That's all I need. I'm good for the rest of the year. That's what he told me. I just saw Prabhupada. That's enough for the rest of the year. So if Krishna had sent that person, that would inspire people. And that's what you need to start a movement. Because when Prabhupada came, there was nobody else. There were no other devotees. And you just came to a room in the storefront, and there was nothing else. You couldn't see a movement. All you saw was him. You can imagine that. Can you imagine? There's no, you can't relate to anything. There's nothing to relate to. There's no other temples. There's no deities. There's no devotees. There's just Prabhupada. So what kind of person does Krishna have to pick to be able to kickstart a movement? Very special. So what do we get from this? When you go back to the story, and Prabhupada says, why are you sleeping? Why aren't you writing books? 1975 or 74 or 72, Prabhupada drops the bomb. What's the bomb? It must have been 1971, 72. By 1975, I want you all to become guru. Been a devotee 1, 2 years, 3 years. What do you think? You all ready? But I one of the things that I get from this story is that when you're Krishna conscious, you affect people. And you don't have to say anything. So we all want to help other people become Krishna conscious. Fundamentally, this is the best way. Isn't it? And this is really how Prabhupada did it, especially in the beginning. And this is how we'll do it also. You've all heard of Jayananda, right? You've heard of Jayananda?
Yes.
Jayananda was very special. There's a story that every year he would have to go to a lady to get the permit to do Ratha Yatra. And the lady was not very nice. It was difficult to deal with. Kind of nasty, you know. Americans can be nasty sometimes. You know that? Some of them. Sometimes. Yeah, people can be nasty anywhere. She wasn't very friendly. Difficult to deal with. Kind of nasty. And he would go every year to get the permit. So he left his body. That year, the devotees had to go get the permit. And said, where's Johnny Ananda? Said, he died. He started crying. Broke down. He had such an effect on him. Can you imagine what kind of person that is? That some nasty clerk would cry? That this person who came every year for 10 minutes to get a permit and died? What kind of effect did he have on him? He was amazing. He was amazing. And he engaged so many people in Krishna consciousness because they were attracted to him. So if you look at how the movement began, nobody knew, really understood Krishna consciousness that well. Nobody was very advanced, but everyone was very attached to Prabhupada. And a very strong desire to serve. So they'd be very enthusiastic chanting japa and doing kirtan. Not like they had a taste for japa or an attachment, but an attachment for Prabhupada. And he wanted us to do that. Of course, the attachment to Krishna developed for many devotees for many years. Not only did they serve because they were attached to Prabhupada, they knew they didn't have attachment for Krishna. They would tell you, I'm here because of Prabhupada. So now we can all become like that, and people will become Krishna conscious. because they become attached to us, because they see something in us. Right? Doesn't that happen? You ready to be Krishna conscious? No, I just rather sell the book. That's easier. You want to hear an interesting story? When we were having all our anti-cult trouble, Prabhupada said, invite them to the temple and let them live with you and see how you live. That was his idea. You know, by seeing the devotees' lives, they would be convinced. Isn't that interesting? And there another thing Prabhupada said? We're having, you know, there were a lot of brainwashing, I don't know a lot, but there were some brainwashing court cases. Prabhupada said, tell them it's too late. The brainwashing books are already out there. Even if you stop us now, it's too late. So I think we should stop, right? Okay. So, thank you very much. We will see you sometime. Some evening.
Tomorrow?
I don't know. That's tomorrow, Monday. I don't know. I haven't scheduled anything. I can schedule. Well, I don't know. Should we?
Yes.
Okay. So tomorrow night.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
My question is, what about Tuesday, Wednesday?
What am I doing on those days? I know Friday I'm going to Tel Aviv. They invited me to come another night. So maybe one other night there. I just have to work it out. Should some special program they wanted me to come to.
It should be either Monday or Wednesday, if you are committed for the one of the days. It's either Monday or Wednesday.
Up there? Yeah. Well, I'll just stay here tomorrow. I'm still recuperating. And then? We'll go from there. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Hari Gopal Premanand. Krishna Hare Krishna. Krishna Hare Krishna.